So, you know, when you're teaching a class for John Kackelman, you have to understand that he's about the most organized individual that you can imagine. So what he handed me was a script, where to click the slides, all the slides made, and the handouts that you have. I only brought the handouts. So that's how unorganized I am. So when I looked at his slides, instead of trying to, I'm so bad with slides, I get worse when I'm using somebody else's slides. So I just had to say, okay, we're not doing that. So this is just me off the cuff on a subject that I haven't studied for a while, so you're probably in for a good ride. But anyway, John did his best and tried to build me up for success, but here I am. So we've been talking about Habakkuk, and Habakkuk's in this situation where he's looking around at the nation that he's in, the chosen people of God that have forgotten their chosen, they've forgotten their God, they've done everything that God told them that they couldn't. He said, I'm going to give you this land, it is a present, it's a gift, if you remember that I am your God, and I don't want you doing the things that all the heathen nations around you are doing. I don't want you worshiping these other things. I don't want you bowing down to these idols. I don't want you doing all of this. Don't be like these nations around. And it's only a number of years before they begin to slide into that kind of debaucherous living and idolatry. And if there's one thing that God hates more than anything, if you can imagine as you're reading through the Old Testament, you know what that is, and it's idolatry. And so how he's got his nation of Israel, and they divide, and now they've got the northern kingdom, the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom never is any good. They never even think about going back. They never look back. It's from King Ahab all the way down, and they all follow in the sins of Jeroboam, and then pretty soon God raises up nations, and we'll talk about a couple of those as well. But here Habakkuk is now looking at this, the last remnant of God's chosen people, the southern kingdom, and he's looking around, and he can't even imagine. In fact, I'm going to bring up a couple of things for you that so that you'll get the flavor of what Habakkuk wants to fly. And I said, no, not really. And they said, well, what do you want to do? I said, I wanted to be on the Calypso. And then as I got older, I thought, do I want to be on the Calypso with all of these French-speaking men and Speedos? And I was thinking, you know, I'm not going to do that. So I went into the Air Force instead. But Jacques Cousteau is my hero. But recently I read a book about him. And you know, Jacques Cousteau is very interesting. He did not start off as an environmentalist. He didn't start off with just this love of the ocean so much. He was a Navy man who loved to make movies. And to the end of his day, he was really about cinematography. He was about telling a story, and he wanted to be a great movie maker. But in there, in his life, you can tell as he concentrates more and more on the oceans, he becomes an idolater. That's what environmental movement is, right? It's idolatry. You're sinning against Mother Earth. It's Mother Earth is more important than its creation, which are the peoples and all the animals. That's the biggest form of idolatry right now, is what we have going, is this environmental movement. It's not conservation, it's environmentalism. It's two different things. So he becomes this idolater about environmentalism. And they asked him, they said, well, you know, is there a God? And he said, well, if there is, he doesn't care about us any more than he cares about the whales or the sand on the sea. Now, does that matter? Like, do people's ideas matter? So when his son Jean-Michel was about 40 years old, had a wife and a child, his mother died of lung cancer, and Jacques Cousteau came to him right after that, sit down, we're going to have lunch, said, you know what, by the way, I've got a second family in Paris that I've had for over 15 years. They're so estranged from each other that Jean-Michel and Jacques Cousteau are suing each other in a court of law. When Jacques Cousteau's on his deathbed, his second wife doesn't allow Jean-Michel and the other children in, and it's just the mess and the morass goes on and on and on. Your view of whether or not God is real and is watching matters. It matters to us to think whether or not God cares and whether he is moving and whether his word is powerful. And that's what Habakkuk is asking, a question that we all do sometimes. Does God really know what's happening? Does he care? Is he really watching? Has he just got the big, huge bird's eye view, or is it something that, does he really know what's happening in my life? It does matter, and Habakkuk begins to lose focus. He begins to get a little bit shaky in his faith, as always we would all do. But also notice that Habakkuk asks a question of God. He's not going to say, you know what, I'm just going to let this fester until I walk away in disbelief. He asks the question, God, I want an answer. And he's going to wait for an answer, and he's going to get an answer. Now, the things that he's putting up with, the best summary you have is about 2 Kings chapter 17. You don't have to read it now, but later on, you're going to read about a people that are idolaters. They're passing their children through the fire. They're harlots. They have whoredoms. They're drunken. They're stealers, they're men stealers, they're oppressing the poor, they're bloodthirsty, they're, you know, they've got male and female prostitutes in a temple, they're practicing sodomy, they're doing all of these things, and that would be God's chosen race. Now Habakkuk's looking at the southern kingdom specifically. Josiah has a great reform, right? He finds the Bible, he finds the text, the sacred text from God, and he starts this great reformation. After 6 years of this reformation, he finally gets to the point where he's brave enough, probably politically strong enough, to go into the temple and tear down the tents of the male sodomite prostitutes in the temple of God. Is that the temple of Jehovah that we've read about? You know, when you have the little flannel board and you go, hey, this is the temple and these are the things. Did you have the prostitute tents up? You had a couple of priests that were a little bit courageous more than anybody else, and they said, you know what, this makes my skin crawl. I can't stand this. So they sneak in there and they take the Ark of God and they go and they put it in hiding because they know that mercy seat is where God said what? That's where I want to meet with you. And the thought of it to them is just absolutely abominable. So they steal the Ark and said, that's not on our watch, you don't. That's after 6 years. The little jars of little kids' bones that they had passed through the fire and they had sacrificed to Baal, those things are uncovered all the time in these excavations outside of Jerusalem. God begged them, don't do it. Don't do it. Somebody said to me that they thought maybe this infanticides and the killing clinics that we have are very similar. And I thought about it for a while and I thought, you know, there probably is a difference. One of them is, you kill a child because you think that's going to appease that God, and I want good fortune. I mean, I don't want anything bad, no bad karma on me. So if I feel like killing my child is going to help with the karma and get me through life better, then I'm going to appease the God, pass him through the fire. And today, the difference would be, well, it's just no God, it's just all about me. I'm going to get through life better. It's going to help me out. So I'll just go over here to the killing clinic. Very similar. The idolatry of a nation. It just takes different forms. So that's what Habakkuk turns around and he looks at. In the beginning we read this, O Jehovah, how long shall I cry? Thou wilt not hear. I cry out unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save. Why dost thou show me iniquity and look upon perverseness? For destruction and violence are before me, and there is strife, and contention riseth up. Therefore the law is slack, and justice doth never go forth. For the wicked doth compass about the righteous. Therefore justice goeth forth perverted. We're going to talk about perverted justice maybe in a week or two. That's going to be an interesting subject because we're living in some of those times right now, and we'll bring some of those examples out. He's asking the question why, and everybody does. Job did it. the saints that are in Revelation are, how long, God? How long until you avenge our blood? And then, of course, your Master and Lord on the cross, why have you forsaken? Elijah's rebuke of Baal reminds me of a word that John Kackelman used. He's got it in your lesson plan. Is God asleep? And when I read that, I thought about it, and I thought, where have I read that before? Is God asleep? And then you remember, you go back to 1 Kings chapter 18 and you think about this standoff between the prophets of Baal and Elijah. When he's all alone, he's got nothing to lose but his life. He thinks he's all alone, he's got no friends, he's going nowhere, the world's coming to an end, so I might as well just cast myself forth and make a last great stand. And so he goes up to the king Ahab and he's like, look, let's just do this thing. Let's get all these 450 prophets together. And he stands before the people. He says, let's go to Mount Carmel and do it. They get over there and he says, look, why are you limping between both sides? Why are you kind of hanging on to this and doing this? If Jehovah God is your God, worship him. If Baal is, worship him. He says, I'll challenge you though. This is what we're going to do. We're going to build some altars, or we're going to put the bullock on the altar. But instead of lighting the fire, we're going to pray. And whatever God sends fire down, that'll be the God. And that he will be God. And they said, you know, that's good for us. That's good for us. And so as they begin to dance and plead and get more and more crescendo, you can think about, you know, people today in these modern religions where you just want more and more emotion, where you just want to just get, you know, so fired up and worked up, because obviously that has something to do with spirituality. So you just keep going, and if we're just enough. And then Elijah begins to mock them as he's watching this spectacle. And he says, maybe your God's on a journey. Maybe he's taking a trip. Maybe he's asleep. But now the tables have turned, haven't they? Now we have a prophet of God wondering, is he here? Is he taking a trip? Is he watching? Is his eyes are upon us? So different when we begin to lose our faith, how quickly we can begin to sound like the world around us. In Psalms 121, God assures us in verse 3 and 4, he says, he that keepeth thee will not slumber. Behold, he that keepeth Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. If you know that, if we come away from the thoughts of the Jacques Cousteau's of the world that just have started this idolatry of environmentalism or this new ageism and all of this nonsense that's going on, if you think about God in heaven, the God of the Bible, that he's watching everything you do and knows everything about your life, is that a comfort, or is that a bit dreadful? I know what the Hebrew writer says in chapter 10, it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of a living God. In other words, all the arguments are going to be over, right? Someday all the debates are going to be done, and all the irrational thinking, all that's finished. Because there's a living God and he's watching over us. Sometimes we may be like Habakkuk, where he begins to tremble, doesn't he? Later on, we find that he begins to think about the judgment of God coming. And he's like, wait a minute, I've been asking for this. Now he says, yeah, it's coming. And when he thinks about it, he begins to tremble a little bit, because maybe it's not so comforting. I found myself in maybe the same situation many times. You know, when we think about God and what he does in this world, you think about things like Manasseh. Manasseh is he's the son of a great king, and he just says, yeah, I'm not going to be like you, Dad. Hezekiah was, you know, you were a faithful guy. You were on your face all the time with God, but I'm not that. I'm doing something different. I want to reintroduce this Baal worship. I want to reintroduce and bring all the prostitution in. I want to live the, you know, bring in all the heathenism that you tore down. I'm putting all the high places back up, and he begins with a vengeance. Of course, the prophets beg him. Ashurbanipal, the king of Assyria, comes marching in. Now, Assyria is kind of starting to wobble at this point. They're not the great Assyria that they used to be. It's not the Shalmanesers. It's not Tiglath-Pileser. This is later on down the line. Sennacherib's already gone, and it's Ashurbanipal, and he comes in, and he says, well, how about I put a big old hook in your jaws and just drag you off? And I've never heard this in a class, but he doesn't take him to Nineveh. He takes him to Babylon. Now, there's a good question for you. Why is he taking the king of Israel to Babylon? That's not his capital. His capital is Nineveh. And sometimes I've wondered if that's not just God trying to get people's attention and going, you know what's coming? You don't think Babylon's a big player now. You're going to hear Babylon out of these prophets' mouths pretty soon. Don't mistake that I can't do whatever it is I want to do. We're going to read that Jeremiah says this about God. When I think it, it's going to come to pass. You know, when he breathes, the mountains shake. When he walks, and it's the oceans part. There will be no God that thinks that things aren't done. He can't speak without things being created or coming crashing down. And so Manasseh goes off to Babylon for just a little, it's just a little sabbatical. And that's the way the Assyrians do it. They'd come up with a big hook, just like you would a big bass hook. They'd just stick it through your jaw, and they'd chain you to the next person, and they would just, you know, march you along like that. These are the kind of guys that when they went in, and let's say when the Elamites kind of got a little froggy, and Assyria was, you know, having a hard time, and so Ashurbanipal, the same guy, goes, you know what, we're going to come up, I'm going to take the head of your king. He takes it, puts it on a chain, puts it around the number one general, and he goes, you march with me. March your king's head with me over to Nineveh. And when we get there, I'm going to have you put it up on the wall. And then, of course, he disrobes his wife. We've got the relief. She's there serving him grapes. He's laying there in front of the head. This is typical fare. This isn't something that's just crazy. This is one kingdom after another. This is one region after another. This is just the way business was done. When Cyrus comes along, they're going to think he's amazing. Because for years, hundreds of years, people just accepted it. But like, yeah, you know, the top 10%, they get their heads lopped off. The rest of you get skinned. Us poor folks, we're just going to get down on our face when the new king comes in. If we're lucky, we'll just start working in the mines for him or something. That's just, we expect that. You know, here's my wives, here's my daughters, I got it, I get it. That's the way the game's played. So Manasseh goes up, and God gets his attention. Because this most wicked of all kings comes back. How is he released? Why does he go to Babylon? How is Jerusalem not sacked by the Assyrians, but their king is taken? There's not any annals in history that can explain it. The Bible leaves so much in the white space, it just boggles your mind. But it absolutely has to come into play, for God takes this king, the most wicked king. He comes back like a guy that just got hit with the stun gun. You ever seen one of those guys? He's so, you know, he's ready to take everybody on until he goes down with the stun gun. Then he's like, hey, well, you know, whatever you want to do. Manasseh comes back. He's like clearing out the temple. Clean out. Get those tents out of there. Do that. Nope. Take those high places down again. Now he's talking to Zedekiah. Now he's talking to the prophets. Hey, can you, you know, what kind of channel of communication we got going on with God? He got his attention, all right. Think about Jehu. When God's going to send a message, he goes, you know, Ahab, you're so wicked, I really can't take any more of this. I wanted you to put the idols away, but you wouldn't. So Jehu now, we're going to crown him because he's the kind of guy that'll at least listen to me. Oh, believe me, I've got no future plans for him, and he's only going to do it for himself. We got that mutual understanding. But when he comes riding in, he's going to start taking every one of Ahab's sons, right? All 70 of them. He's going to take hundreds of prophets of Baal and just butcher them. And you just can't imagine that God says, you know, I've been asking you to put that away. I've been asking you not to do this. No, you will put it away. No, you could have done it on my terms, but you will put it away. I mean, when we're told that every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess, you ought to do it now. Because God's going to come in someday and he's going to go, I told you every knee will bow. You will do it. Best be on your terms. So Jehu just goes through and just starts butchering. Then he gets the king of Israel, the king of Judah, and they're in concert, which they shouldn't be, right? And they're together in the same place. And Jehu comes riding in, and they're looking out from the watchtowers, and they're like, that looks like Jehu, because he's driving that chariot furiously. So they say, hey, send the message to him. Is it peace with you, Jehu? And that messenger just gets turned aside. And the watchman goes, hey, he just turned him aside. He's not sending him back. Oh, okay, well, send another one. Is it peace with you, Jehu? And he's looking out and he's like, he just turned that guy aside. He's coming. He's furiously driving. So the two kings get together and decide, well, you know what? We'll go up here and we'll take a look at this and we'll talk to Jehu. So we got Ahaziah and then Jehoram from the northern kingdom. Now, where do they go to meet Jehu but a place called Naboth, or where Naboth's property was in Jezreel? Does that ring a bell? Naboth of Jezreel. So that's the one that Jezebel says, hey, Ahab, you want that? Let's just kill him and take his property. And God said, no, I can't look on that. That's going to cost you. It's going to cost you all the seed that you have, every one of your sons, and where you spilled his blood, you're going to fertilize that soil. And now here, years later, Jehu is riding his chariot. They go out to meet him, and they can only see him from a distance, and they're yelling at him, and they say, hey, is it peace with you? And Jehu's like, you know what? Not as long as the whoredoms of Jezebel continue. And then he drives an arrow from the back all the way through the front of this guy as he's trying to flee. And he falls right there at Naboth's property that his father had taken and murdered the man for. When God's fed up, he's fed up. His long suffering is only so long. In Habakkuk 1:5-6, he gives an answer. He said, behold you among the nations, and look and wonder marvelously, for I am working a work in your days which you will not believe, though it be told you. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation that march through the breadth of the earth to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. There's three lines I want you to look at. He says, look and wonder marvelously. The words are in the Hebrew are be astonished or be astounded, be astounded. I'm going to say it twice. I'm going to emphasize it. When you figure out that I am working, it's going to be astounding, astounding that you're not going to be able to believe it. And then he says, even I'm working, I'm doing something, and you're not going to believe it even if I told you. You know, when we say that we worship the great I am, that's an admission. When God says I am, it's not just I am, I'm existing. It is I am. This is his world. This is his universe. I am. When I think, it will be done. Things will move. Mountains will move. Oceans will part. He says, I am working a work. And this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to raise up the Chaldeans. Now who, just as a sideline, you know this, hey, I'm working and working your days that you won't believe even if I told you. Who quotes that? That's Paul, isn't it? In Acts chapter 13. When he's in Antioch of Pisidia, he quotes that. Now listen to this. This is a little bit of a sideline. Would you have ever read that in the Old Testament and thought, he's talking about the gospel system and the Gentiles coming into the kingdom? He's talking about those Jews that are not going to obey the gospel. That the same wrath that Habakkuk's about to witness is what God's saying, you know, I've got the gospel. It's coming your way. It's about Jesus Christ on the cross. And if you disobey and obey not the gospel, I want you to remember these words. You know that day when the Babylonians came in and people were eating their children? It was really messy. Now, the point is this. In 1 Peter, you're going to find out that you're not allowed to just interpret any prophecy you want in any way you want. If you're a premillennialist, you know what you've got to say about future prophecies? Yeah, you're done. Because if you don't have an inspired interpretation, you have no idea what it's talking about. Ever. It takes an inspired interpretation. We read about things like David's tabernacle being rebuilt. Who would have ever thought that meant let the Gentiles into the kingdom? But that's what it meant in Acts chapter 15, didn't it? And it's the same thing here. This is something that Paul quotes and says, well, we're going to use it again in a different way. I think we have trouble because of 2 Corinthians 4 and 18. We look at the things that are seen, and yet we're supposed to be looking at the things not seen. The things that are seen are temporal, but that's what we're surrounding our lives in this, and the things that are unseen are eternal. God is behind the scenes, or is it, he's not really behind the scenes, but it's just hard to detect what he is doing. But he says, you can rest assured, I am working. I'm working a work in your day. I mean, think about this. When he mentions the Medes, in Isaiah 13 and 14, he mentions the Medes. The Medes, at the time that Isaiah speaks that, they're like a wayward Bedouin tribe. They're still working on their bows and trying to, you know, figure out how to sit, where to sit on the horse. They're just, you know, the Medes. What do you mean the Medes? We are a world power. We got us, we got those guys across the ocean, we got those guys in Eurasia. What are you talking about, the Medes? And it's only a matter of time before the Medes are going to come marching in and they are going to start destroying things. And this big world power of Assyria that we thought was so powerful, that has the greatest army the world had ever seen at that time. Usually, you got a country like Judah, you're going to put out 50,000, maybe 100,000 people, and you're going to think, wow, we've got it going on. Assyria is going to field divisions of 50,000 troops that are trained. And then they're still going to go up, and they're going to run into the Scythians. And the Scythians are what? It's the same people as the Kyrgyzstans, Tajikistans, the Afghanistans, all the Eurasian steppe today. They were just as problematic back in the day when they were the Scythians. Hey, why don't you come out, stand in front of us, and let us fight like we're supposed to? And all they're doing is running around with horses, shooting at arrows from behind things, and then running off on the other side of the mountains and everything. They haven't changed a bit. When the Soviet Union went in there in the 80s, everybody knew, you know, you're in some serious trouble. They're not going to fight like you want to do. You had to leave all your armor home, and they are just going to have at you guys. Which is exactly what happened. And the same thing happens to the Assyrian army when they're dealing with the Scythians. And the Scythians are going to want to come down. They're going to start weakening the Assyrian army. And people are going to be sitting there scratching their heads going, what in the world's going on? This whole balance of power thing is getting out of control. As that happens, God continues to tell them, I'm going to raise up certain armies. He says, I'm going to raise up the Chaldeans. They know who they are. They know who the Babylonian Empire is. They've been around for a long time. But they were somebody 2,000 years ago. But they're nobody now. They're paying tribute to the Assyrians like everybody is. They're not anybody. That's why the Assyrian king could grab an Israelite king and take him by the jaws and just march him into Babylon and do whatever and then leave. It's just, they're just a vassal state. And he says, no. Next, I'm going to rise them up, and they're the ones that you're going to fear. God can do anything. This is his world. This is his universe. He is watching, and he does care, and he is going to bring things about that he wants to bring about. So as Assyria begins to weaken, you have Asher up on the Tigris, you have Nineveh, the Medes go up. The Babylonians are like the Medes. They've been under the rule of Assyria, and they're like, you know, we've had enough. naval palacer. He goes, you know, hey, we're going to go over here and we're going to shake off the Assyrian bondage. He doesn't even get there fast enough. The Medes are already at Asher. Asher is a huge, great, big city-state at that time on the Euphrates River, or on the Tigris River. So it's really close to Nineveh, and it's one of the strongholds of the Assyrian army. And the Medes go up there under Cyaxares, and they take it. So the Babylonians can't even get there. And when they get there, they're a little miffed, just like, hey, I thought we were in this together. I mean, you're taking the spoils without us, it's, you know. Well, then they're like, hey, we got it. We got Nineveh. You know that city over here that's 30 by 10? 30 miles by 10 miles? You know the one that's got 300-foot walls? That's over here. So they take their armies and they march up there in about 612. And, of course, nobody thinks Nineveh's ever going to fall. Who would have thought that except maybe a guy named, say, Nahum? When Nahum says, you know what? Nineveh's going to fall. We probably don't even have in our mind right now what that would have been like. That would have been more like the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the U.S. when we all had nukes and we were just right on the button and people, you know, were kind of thinking, yeah, there's this, these two powers are about to go at it. Nineveh's that powerful and nobody can even come close. And Nahum says, you know what? God's going to make this thing so desolate. He's going to take this city down. And so when God breathes, when God thinks, when he speaks, something begins to happen. 200 years later, after that, when Nineveh falls, you've got Xenophon, right? One of the first historians, one of the Greek generals. He's riding through that territory. 200 years later, he comes up to these massive walls. He goes, what in the world was here? He asked everybody around him, hey, what? You guys familiar with the city? No, but they got some old Bedouins around here. They got some jackals in the wall over here. There's some coyotes that are running around over there. He's looking at this thing going, this is incredible. What is this? When God wants to take care of a nation, it doesn't matter what happens. He takes Nineveh, who's the world power, and in 200 years, have you ever seen the Planet of the Apes? Where, you know, Charlton Heston has that Statue of Liberty moment, which I think we're coming too closer, right? He at the very end of the movie, he's thinking, where am I? What's happening? I can't believe I'm here. I want to get back. I want to get back. I want to get back. And then at the very end of the moment, or the end of the movie, he looks over, and in the sands where the seashore is washing up, he sees the Statue of Liberty half buried in the sand. This is like that Statue of Liberty moment where this great city like New York is something that people have forgotten was there. And then when Alexander the Great marches through a little bit later in 331, he's going to Arbela, he's looking at it too. He's like, I don't remember a city was here. What do you mean there's big walls there? Who's living in them? This stuff goes into 1850 before we have somebody on site that's actually doing this excavation, and they send this boy that keeps sitting around. He's getting in the way. He's staring at him. They're like, look, kid, you know, we got business to do here. So finally they go, you know what, why don't you go over there and sweep? You see all that? There's a big flat roof over there or a floor. Go sweep that floor. Kid goes over there and starts sweeping the floor every morning, gets up, goes over there and just wants to clean it. Just wants to be part of it. He keeps going until finally he sweeps away so much dirt that that floor starts caving a little bit, starts caving in, and they realize it's not a floor. It's a ceiling that had caved in on something called Sennacherib's palace. See, up until that point, people were saying, well, yeah, the Bible's making a lot of stuff out of this. It's not, can't be. That palace is about 3 football fields in size. We didn't even know. I mean, we were just, maybe this is made up. Maybe the Bible just made up. I listen to a historian right now. He doesn't believe a word of the Bible. He just thinks it's good old ancient, you know, literature. He's like, well, if a historian like Herodotus says something different, we know the Bible's wrong. It's like, well, I don't know how many times you got to play that game, but so there's Sennacherib's palace. We still don't know anything about Assyria at that point. Then they go down in there and they find 100 1,000 volumes in a library that Ashurbanipal put together. So he's not only Ashurbanipal is not only a powerful, murderous, brutal king, but he's just got something about history. He's collected writings all the way from Pakistan, all the way down through the Mediterranean, everywhere the Assyrian armies marched. He was collecting stuff and put it in this palace. And then we just started going crazy reading all this and realizing, well, this is what these people are saying about what the Jews said their God did. When God said he's going to rise up a nation or take a nation down, it happens with his very thought. You can see that throughout history again and again, and everything will come to pass. In the end, we have to understand that God is in control, but that does not mean that everything happens is what he wants to happen. Now, I know that doesn't sound right. He set this world up so it has eternal moral laws. If you break those laws, things happen. You know, one of the biggest lies today is this multiculturalism. Well, all cultures are equal. I actually hear Christians buying off on that stuff now, and I'm like, what do you mean all cultures are equal? You mean somebody that follows the Bible as a person somehow in their life is not more at peace and tranquility than somebody that's out there that says, there is no God that's watching me. And if my family is built on a pattern of God, you're saying my family is the same as a family that Joe Biden could say, you know what? It doesn't really matter what makes up the family. Let's just get rid of this idea of the family. You dress how you want. We don't want any gender critical people around. This is all just, you know, whatever family you want to put together. Is that what we've come to? When a culture or a community starts following the Bible, is that community no better off than a community that passes their children through the fire? Multiculturalism. No, sir, not in God's world. Not in God's world. His people have been told that your way won't be easy. It's not going to be without challenge. It's not going to be without sorrow. But you want to make it worse? You want to bring chaos and trauma into your life? Tell John I didn't follow a thing in his lesson, so I owe him a whole lesson. We got one of his thoughts in, I think. I appreciate your time and your attention. Thanks so much.